sometimes, you know, people want to do too much for you. You know, you have a simple little headache, and so everybody rushes around getting aspirins and water and beds and cushions and, you know, and so on. You just say, let me be, you know, let me be for a moment, sort of thing. But we slash about, you know, saying, you see how compassionate and understanding I am. I feel so sorry for you, you know, I want to help you. You say, reminds me of the Boy Scout who, you know, has to do a good deed every day, and so he sees a little old lady standing at the side of the street, and he immediately helps her across the street. And she said, but I didn't want to cross the street. But he felt very righteous and virtuous because he had his good deed for the day. So we have to stand this. We have to understand that to see is not to be without compassion. There is tremendous compassion. We gather the fleece from the emotional sheep that when the sun is gone down, when they're no longer violent. And so we have the essence of it, which is, of course, linked with the true love, true compassion. The analogy, I think, used in the Bhagavad Gita is a beautiful one. When, as a tortoise, draws in on all sides its limbs, he withdraws his senses from the objects of sense, then is his understanding well poised. This is the state of true seeing. Now, in such a condition of true perception, the thinking function, well established so that it can be used in the right place, and in accordance with its proper function, the inner voice may be heard. So the next step is consequently to recognize that before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Now this, of course, is the voice of intuition, the intuitive function, and as analysis, of course, will show, represents the correct development of that function, closely related to and complementing the thinking function psychologically. Theosophically, of course, it is the Buddhic aspect which now must illumine the mind. HPV called this state of the mind manas-kajasa, the illumined or splendidly radiant mind, manas-kajasa, the radiant mind. And the ear has been called a symbol of the mental faculty in its passive aspect, implying a receptivity to inner guidance, to the voice of conscience, which is the voice of true concern, not a sloppy sentimentality, but a concern which arises out of a recognition that there is a dearness, a preciousness in all things, that which the Buddhist calls the Dharma nature residing in everything. This is, of course, the first step in the Paramitas, Dhamma, key of charity and love immortal, which is the fact that in all things, in everything, there is a dearness, a preciousness. And so our concern is for that dearness in all things. Hearing, then, is symbolic of the intuitive perception, which can only come when the mind is poised, clear, unmoved by passion or attachment to the objects of the senses. There is, as the Gita tells us, the pouring as sacrifice, hearing and the other senses into the fire of restraint. This is, of course, the alchemical process. So the lower aspect of hearing as one of the senses, intuition in its guise as instinct, is transformed into that genuine listening which is an interior receptivity to wisdom. And for this process, there must be a loss of sensitiveness, or again, an immovability. For sensitivity implies the possibility of movement, of disturbance, even of excitability. And if one is to listen, to hear the voice of the inner self, there can be no disturbance, no distractions. The mind must be utterly quiet. So, now of course, as we examine these statements, we have to remember that words can often be used with dual meanings. And while language is extremely useful in clarifying concepts, it can also have a certain clumsiness, as we well know. English, of course, is not given to being a very philosophical language. The most truly philosophical language is Sanskrit, naturally. But it is. Sanskrit is a highly metaphysical language, a highly philosophical language. But English is a very useful language, fortunately. Today it is almost a world language. It's the language of commerce. It's the language of getting on in the world as it is, in that sense. But words both reveal and obscure meaning. They both release ideas and contain ideas. So it is with this word sensitiveness, which sometimes strikes the student with a certain harshness, as though the aim is to become coldly indifferent to the needs of others and the world about us. And we often feel, because we use the word impersonal, that we must be cold and indifferent and unfeeling. Should we not, we argue, increase our sensitivity, not diminish it or lose it altogether? Should we not be sensitive to beauty, to suffering, to aspiration, to longings? Insensitive to our own desires, yes, we may say, but surely we ought to become more and more sensitive to life about us. But observe the derivation of the word, so closely related to the verbal root that refers to sensory perception based upon external stimuli, so that in one of its meanings, sensitivity implies a responsiveness to or a recording of the slightest changes that take place without. Now consider the experience of meditation, especially in its beginning stages. It frequently occurs when we first take up the practice of meditation that we find ourselves in a state in which the faintest external sound disturbs us. We say we are so sensitized that even the rustle of leaves in the slightest breeze distracts us. We then begin to think about the wind, its strength, the velocity. From that we go on to think about the weather and the day ahead of us. Next our mind roams to a consideration of what we better wear for the day, whether the soft breeze portends a stronger gale that could bring rain, even a storm. Very soon we're far away from our original meditation, aren't we? Because that slightest sound has disturbed us, we say. From spiritual matters, we've come to the most mundane of considerations. Listening to the wind in the leaves of the tree outside the window, we fail to hear the wind of the spirit within, through the windows of the self, windows which can open inwards the realm of immortal being. So the sensitiveness that we must lose is that responsiveness which is reactionary in nature and which draws the mind outwards and involves it again, you say, in all kinds of agitations, all kinds of transformations, vrittis, to use the term that Patanjali uses in the sutras, Yoga Sutras, to external stimulations that sway the mind, sending it rushing about among all the objects of sense perception in a manner that further confuses appearance with reality, the ephemeral with the eternal. What we have to learn to hear is the sound of the self in all things. What is the sound of the self? The reverberating thunder, it's called in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the reverberating thunder of the Atma nature embedded in the static and noise of external forms. Can you hear that? For there is an immortal resonance in every fragment of life. Mesmer said to us later in our text, there is a natural melody, an obscure funk in every heart. Only when we have become insensitive to all external sounds can we detect the sweet voice at the heart of life itself. So the intuition speaks to us when the outer senses are stilled and the mind becomes inwardly illumined, radiant, such that Manas Tejasa, in its aspect of Buddhi Manas, the emotions have not been lost. They've not been killed out. They've not been trampled. You need the emotional nature because man is this square in which he must use the emotional nature, but he is polishing, of course, the rough ashlar of that square into the perfect form. And so he uses the emotional nature as the perfect resonating instrument of Buddha. It is a resonating instrument now, not a reactionary instrument, you see. It resonates here. It is the device by which, and this is very important, the device by which we can vibrate outwards in through the personality those interior resonances of the immortal self. Now, a further point may be noted in regard to these first two sentences of the opening paragraph. In the first sentence, I've already commented, the plural form of eyes is used, whereas in the second, there is the singular word ear. And as I said, from the strictly physiological point of view, we have two ears as we have two eyes. So it's quite obvious that we're dealing with a highly symbolic statement. Psychologically meaningful as we examine their intent. So as already indicated, the plural form of eyes relates to the duality of mind's functioning. And if we use the analogy of the sword, we recognize that the mind not only functions in a dual manner, but is capable of discrimination, that is, of cutting through or severing one thing from another. In this sense, it may be said to dismember, that is, to take apart. And indeed, the first set of rules in the text which follows, as we'll see tomorrow, are concerned with this process of dismemberment, which is a necessary psychological stage in achieving the state of self-realization. One has to dismember before one can remember. Now, the singular form ear refers to the internal organ of the mind, its receptivity as a reflecting surface for intuition, or buddhi, and therefore our capacity for listening to that interior voice is dependent upon the singularity of attention directed inwards without any distraction from the sense. In one sense, we're dealing with, you see, generally people say, set aside the mind, and jump to buddhi, you see. Our focus really is on the cognizing element, which is the internal cognizing principle, which is composed technically of four aspects, of buddhi, manas, chitta, and ahankara. And this, of course, you will find in the Secret Doctrine. I'm not trying to give you a course in the Secret Doctrine. I assume you all know that. You know what the Secret Doctrine says. But these are the fourfold internal cognizing principle. And so in its aspect as manas alone, it has this duality. In its aspect as buddhi, it is singular, the ear. And so from the harmonized or synchronized state, symbolized by the two eyes in perfect focus, listening becomes possible. Neither tears resulting from emotional attachments, nor external sensitivity resulting from the noise of our personal concerns can be permitted to distract us from the tasks at hand. All too often, of course, the beginner on the journey is fascinated by all that he sees and hears about him. And he, of course, like many, mistakes the psychic experiences of seeing color or hearing sound for the genuine spiritual experience in which the mind is utterly still, and the voice of intuition or the voice of the silence can be heard as the slightest whisper which reverberates through the whole being. And ultimately, he is the sounding board of Atma. The personality becomes then not only filled with light, exuding light through all its orifices, but it is the perfect resonating instrument for the Atma. And this, of course, is the transfiguration of the physical vehicle. This is what has to be brought about in incarnation. We are the resounding board of nature. And then is as though the person who is in this state is as though he gives forth not only light, but he gives forth music. There is a sweetness of melody in his very presence. Now, these first two sentences of our preliminary paragraph of the text deal then with the clearing of the internal state of consciousness, the clearing of the field, we can call it. And in a condition of inward harmonization, we are now prepared to turn outward, confident of an external stance that perfectly reflects the inner equilibrium. In other words, what has been impressed must now be expressed with no obstructions to the flow of light and life along this ego-self axis or the personality-individuality polarity. Actually, it is a bringing of the self into the personal life rather than a simple flow of light from the one to the other. This is also why HPB makes the statement, Atma and physical are one. There is no difference, because the physical incarnation, so perfectly reflects and resonates to Atma that there is no distinction. This is what is aimed at. Now, this is indicated, I think, by the phrase found only in the two final sentences of our paragraph. In the presence of the Master. You notice in the first two sentences, that little phrase is not there. It's only in the last two sentences. From the point of view of the psychological interpretation of our text, the reference here is not to any external master, so much as to the self, the immortal self within, that master within, the inner Christ, the inner Buddha, the immortal Atman. To speak and to stand in the presence of the Master means simply, I suggest, that our presence in the world is that transpersonal presence which brings the universe into the particular, analogous to the manner in which Jesus spoke of that power, Christ or God, which worked through him to achieve healing and wholeness. Not I, but the Father, you remember. It's always his statement. And so, to stand in the presence of the Master is to permit that interior Buddha, your own Buddha nature, Christ nature, the Master within, to stand in physical incarnation. Therefore, while from one point of view, our clearing of the field of consciousness results in the realization that all the time we have been in the presence of the Master as self-realized individuals, represented by those adepts in the esoteric wisdom, from another and perhaps even deeper perspective, the interior psychological task required of us culminates in the recognition that only when the eyes of the dual functioning mind and the ear of intuitive perception have been coordinated, harmonized, and restrained from attachment to the senses, that is, without tears, can the transpersonal express itself in every moment of daily life. Whatever you are doing, the transpersonal is acting in the personal. I think this is what it means to be present in the world. To be present, wholly, completely present in the world in such a manner that one's very presence transforms the world. I feel a great ideal is to be present where one is. Generally, we're not. We're always, you know, our minds are somewhere else. We're not present where we are. Somebody comes to us, they're talking to us. All the time we're thinking, how soon is this person going to go away? You know, I really wanted to be alone. I really wanted to watch a TV show tonight. I wanted to do this. I meant to do that. I wonder what I can do tomorrow. What am I going to say to this person? You know, how am I going to help him? Our mind, we're not present. To be present where one is. This is washing dishes, of course. When I wash cups, I wash cups. To be present where one is. And this is to transform the world. Our words and actions are no longer reactive responses to stimuli from without. They are the natural and spontaneous creative expressions of the self within, known to be the one self in all. So to speak and to stand are outer expressions of an inner attitude to see and to hear. They reflect, even at the personal level, what we are within. How often, for example, mood can be detected by inflection of a voice or the stance assumed by an individual. Even in outer ways, we may not even need to see a person to know from his voice, by the telephone, for example, whether he is happy or unhappy, depressed or elated. Nor need we hear him speak if we see him sitting or standing with mouth downturned and shoulders drooped and so on. You may say, what's wrong today? If you see a person sort of, you know, lethargic in his movements. So what we are within at any moment must inevitably reflect itself even in our outer expression. Even in isolation we have an impact on the world, for thought and emotion are as much expression of speech and action as our actual voice and stance. No man is an island, you remember, John Donne reminded all of us. This is true of the inner man as well as of the outer. Psychologically, of course, the thinking intuitive individual with those functions well differentiated may be inadequate in his feeling sensation axis of consciousness orientation. But our task is to differentiate each of these clearly, each of the axial points of consciousness in its contact with the world about us. And only thus, I think, do we become whole and in the process heal the world. Now, in a note then, at the beginning of the second section of Light on the Path, we are told that to be able to speak is to have attained the power of helping others. Now, this is only a positive rephrasing of the rather negative injunction that the voice must have lost the power to wound. Now, speech or voice represents a tremendous creative energy. I think it is man's atomic power, the voice. It's a tremendous energy. The creative power, actually, which called a universe into being.
It is known, as you know, as the Logos in the Platonic, Neoplatonic, and Gnostic traditions, as Vak in its various transformations in Hindu philosophy, the female Kwannon or Kuan Yin in yet other Eastern schools, and a full exposition of the metaphysical concept, Logos or Vak or Kwannon, Kuan Yin, would take us very far afield from for our immediate concern is not so much with these philosophical ideas underlying our text, but with the very practical import in terms of the work that is involved. Yet it is very interesting, and you can study it. HPB, of course, goes into this in some detail in The Secret Doctrine. And there is a whole philosophy, of course, that deals with the coming into manifestation of the word and its various aspects of Bach. I'm not going to go into all of that. Aren't you glad there's some things I'm not going to go into? But naturally, an understanding of the philosophy will influence the direction of the work we're undertaking. For I think only a philosophy that ascribes meaningfulness and significance to universal process can impart meaning and significance to the human opus, the human work. If the universe is meaningless, then, of course, man is meaningless. If everything in the universe is but a chance occurrence, then our lives are without meaning, sterile and futile. And, of course, the theosophical philosophy, above all, imparts meaning. It affirms meaning and undergirds meaningfulness with intentionality, recognizing that man fulfills the process in self-conscious existence. His journey, in other words, is both obligatory and self-chosen. You can find this in the proem. You don't have to read very far in The Secret Doctrine to find this. It's right in the proem, near the beginning. If you're afraid of the rest of it, just read the proem. That's enough. Now, to speak is to reenact the creative process at every single moment. That is to bring into existence that which is inherently, to bring beingness into being through the process of becoming, of actualizing the real without distortion or injury to the real, without the power to wound. This, therefore, is to speak without the power to wound. The essential differentiation of the feeling function by which emotion is cleansed of all impurities of passion or sentiment. As I've already said, the emotions are not to be destroyed, but purified. Psychic energy is not to be dammed up, but the stream bed through which it flows is to be cleared of impedimenta that obstruct its passage. So we are dealing here with a very fundamental power. Indeed, I think one of the powers latent in man, to which the third object refers, which has scarcely yet been explored. Unfortunately, it's a power very much taken for granted. Everybody has a voice. Generally, everybody speaks, except at occasions like this, when I make you all be quiet, and I'm doing the speaking. But, you know, generally, when we have tea or go in the dining room or after these sessions, everybody is, you know, we're all speaking. We don't hesitate to speak. We go on about it. So we take this for granted. And so, as speech comes quite naturally to the human being, we often restrain it with a certain difficulty. Witness the compulsive nature of gossip. When a story, we say, is too good to be kept for oneself alone, so we like to pass it on to someone else. Often with the rejoinder, of course, that please don't share it any further, you know. And so pretty soon it's shared by everybody. There is in the Theosophical Society the most amazing grapevine, you know, it's marvelous. And I hear things that absolutely incredible, you know, which started out with one thing, by the time it reaches me, you know, I mean, it starts out with one thing at Adyar, and by the time I get to England, it's absolutely incredibly distorted. Marion is nodding. I think we had an incident of it not long ago, you know. And it's incredible how this happens. So we do it. Now, in the secret doctrine, as I've said, HPB equates the word, voice or sound, and speech as the active forces in nature of the mystery of sound and speech, so that she adds that the words spoken by, as well as the name of every individual, largely determine his future fate. The words spoken by, as well as the name of every individual, largely determine his future fate. And she quotes a French author, commending his words as very true to the esoteric teaching. To pronounce a word is to evoke a thought and make it present. The magnetic potency of human speech is the commencement of every manifestation in the occult world. The word, or the speech of every man, is, quite unconsciously to himself, a blessing or a curse. So we have to learn to speak. In the presence of the Master, which means in the presence of the immortal Atman, not simply some external guru, some master, some external adept, even one of our well-known masters whom we greatly revere in the Theosophical movement. It is to speak, to use this creative force at the physical level, which is a force of the Atman itself. The burden of the work now being undertaken, in other words, makes it imperative that the unconscious use of this power must now become conscious. Speech must be a blessing, never a curse. Now, in an effort, of course, to ensure that speech is a blessing only, we may determine upon a course of silence. We can say, well, I'm not going to say another word the rest of my life. It's very much akin, of course, to the idea that the only remedy for a headache is to cut off your head. Speech, of course, is not only vocal and verbal. It is the resonance of our whole being. The entire physical body becomes the voice when properly used. For nature herself is never silent, as our text reminds us. So the entire physical body. Now there's a marvelous work that deals with this by a scientist, Dr. Donald Patch Andrews, in a work called The Symphony of Life. Dr. Andrews, who was at Johns Hopkins University in the United States, worked very closely with Fritz Kunz, whose name may be familiar to some of you, was a very eminent theosophist and who lived here at the manor for some time as the secretary to CWL, and who married, of course, one of the young people trained by CWL, Dora Van Gelder, Dora Kunz, who's now the head of the American section.
Well, was in one of the group photographs that are down below.
Yes. Fritz worked very closely with Dr. Donald Hatch Andrews, and they produced a film called The Symphony of Life, which is a very interesting film in which Dr. Andrews pursued this matter that everything by its shape has a particular sound, by the its atomic structure had a particular resonance and can be amplified in a way so that you hear the sound of statues, for example, in a museum. And he shows this, he gives a lot of this information. And it's very fascinating, but the book is called The Symphony of Life, as is the film, and you can read about it. All atomic structure reverberates. It is vibratory, isn't it? It is in vibratory motion. Sound, of course, audible sound, we all know, is only a certain part of the spectrum of vibration, isn't it? Certain other spectrums are color. Isn't that right? We all know that. I trust you all know that. I may not be saying it very well, but I'm not much of a scientist, a very, very poor scientist, in fact. One thing I failed in school pretty much. But anyway, What I understand of it is that everything in the universe reverberates. That is sound. Now, the whole fabric of the manifested universe is called Akasha in the Sanskrit, from the simple word that means radiant, radiant, light. And the chief characteristic of Akasha, says HPB, is sound. This is the reverberation, therefore. So speech, then, ultimately is the reverberation of the entire vehicle, certainly even of the entire physical body. So what is your body saying? Not just I am hungry, I mean, don't tell me that. But what is it saying? Does it wound? Does it heal the universe? Silence, then, even is part of that voice. Whether the stony silence of disapproval or the sympathetic silence of loving compassion, even silence is the reverberation of sound. What is aimed at, then, is that the energy represented by speech is utilized constantly for healing, for making whole. This again is well illustrated in one of the versions of the Parsifal legend, in which the Fisher King is suffering a mysterious malady which has laid waste the entire countryside. And while various knights come daily to inquire about the king's health, you know, how are you, inquiries that represented self-centered concerns, sentiments, sentimentality. It was only when Parsifal, the innocent fool whose very purity marked his unique development, asked the fundamental question, where is the Grail, that the king was restored to health and the land made fertile once again. To speak the right word, to ask the right question, to put aside any emotionalism that deflects attention from the central goal, this is to attain the power of helping others and to speak in the presence of the masters. Begin to see. It was Emerson who said, what you are, speak so loudly, I cannot hear the words you say. So it is this speech, to speak in the presence of the masters, to have lost the power to wound. Well, we come then to the final statement. Are you still with me?
Yes.
We have one more to go of this preliminary paragraph. Completing the quaternary of those functions by which consciousness orients itself to the world. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. Now, here we are confronted psychologically with the need to differentiate the function of sensation, to be distinguished from sensitiveness, that is to be lost before intuition can function properly. And so it is very definitely related, as intuition and sensation are complementary functions. The sensation function is characterized by its immediate apperception of the circumstances of existence. And the feet of the soul represent physical existence. And only, of course, when the personality has been brought into a fit condition, washed in the blood of the heart, we'll come to that, can the senses, instruments of sensation, give correct information, enabling us to contact the world about us without emotionalism, without prejudice, wishful fantasy, and so on. Any of the other blinders that obscure the vision of the things as of things as they are. For the world may be Maya. You know, we love to go around as with the auspices and say, well, it's all Maya anyway, you see. Illusory appearance on the screen of reality, but it has its own reality in accordance with the laws of reflection. The mirror image may be distorted by any of a number of factors, and our task is to ensure there is no distortion. Inevitably, it seems, there is pain in this process. The blood of the heart washes over us until we are able to stand steady and see truly. So what is sought is actually a perfect alignment of inner realization with outer expression. It is the soul, that is the interior center of the immortal self, that will stand in the presence of the masters, that is, will recognize its own inherent divinity. But this can only occur when the physical foundation or outer personality symbolized by the feet has been attuned to or aligned with this inherent, its source, its own source, so that its action is free, compassionate, and understanding. Through the physical personality, in physical incarnation, where we're possessed of feet that can stand upon the earth, we must endure the strain and struggle that ultimately enable us to stand everywhere and anywhere. So the blood of the heart is, of course, emblematical of the pain of our own crucifixions here and now, and of the endurance which is born of those crucifixions. Again and again, we have to recognize a crucifixion is only the crossroad of decision. When one is at the center, there is no movement, and that all movement is possible. Blood is also the symbol of the divine life manifested on the lower planes, and so is often used as emblematic of the soul, the link between spirit and body, and it is therefore the essence of life itself. In scripture and myth, the symbolism of blood is often used to denote the living bond between the divine and man, as well as between man and man, blood covenants, blood compacts, and so on. Again, we are referring to a life fluid, to an energy, therefore, and a full exploration of so very potent a symbol would carry us very far away from our present course, and you'd miss dinner altogether. But no theme in myth or ritual is more significant in indicating the fundamental attitude of sacrifice which must accompany conscious growth from the personal to the transpersonal. As the heart signifies love and aspiration, the yearning of the disciple for the highest, the heart's blood represents the required sacrificial attitude in which all circumstances are recognized as part of the therapy of growth. In many traditions, of course, the heart is the symbol of the causal vehicle, that element in man's nature which is the seat of the soul and from which reincarnation takes place. And the blood of the heart, then, refers to the purificatory process which is achieved only through rebirth. The Egyptian mysteries, for example, lay great stress on that interpretation and shows the stream of the Egyptian mysteries in this great work. So the recognition here of the whole purpose of physical incarnation, there is a purpose in being in physical incarnation with its attendant joys and sorrows, ultimately enables us to meet all experiences with an equanimity whose principal expression is courage, to be able to stand. This is to have confidence, to have trust. At the feet of the Master discusses this. Trust yourself, trust the Master. Have confidence as one who evermore endures, says the voice of the silence. Have confidence, candidate, as one who evermore endures. To be able to stand is to have confidence. What W.Q. Judge called the karmic stamina. I think we have to have this. Confidence is gained, however, not out of an easy life, a life full of pleasantries. It's won on the battlefield of choice, the endless small choices of each day, and the overriding one choice that has led us to take up the work of conscious evolution in earnest. It's out of all the little choices, really. It's so easy to overlook then, but it's the little choices that ultimately add up. You know, or as one writer puts it, we have to suffer the hell of our refusals. This really is what happens. It's not a self-assertive confidence in which the personality suffers from what is known as psychological inflatus, but it's an attitude born of trust. So very beautifully expressed, I think, in the title of that lovely little book by Clara Codd, Trust Yourself to Life. So it's that kind of standing, confident that there is lawfulness in the universe. We act then as the moment requires, with a courage that is neither rash nor studied, but flows from a perfect trust in the supreme order of life itself. So the initial paragraph of our text describes a condition that may be termed preparatory at the same time, as I say, that it points towards the fulfillment of our task. And it outlines the essential fourfoldness of the functioning of consciousness in its inward-turned and outward-turned aspects. Each one of the functions, thinking, intuition, feeling, sensation, must be brought into an equality of action. Each must be given, must be used in its appropriate manner, given its due, as a Masonic ritual phrases it. It's a council of perfection, perhaps, but as Robert Browning so aptly remarked, a man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? So not one aspect of our nature is to be neglected. What is aimed at is a development that is balanced, whole, and complete. And for this reason, the paragraph comes at the very outset, that we are reminded at the very outset that you can neglect nothing. If we went immediately into the rules, kill out, you'd say, oh, we're going to, you know, be ruthless, slash about, you see, and kill out everything. But we're reminded at the very outset that what is aimed at is a complete, balanced, and harmonious development in which the personality is above all required, so don't get rid of it. When the time comes, you know, it will go its own way. It will be sloughed off, and you'll get another one in due time. But while you have it, treasure it. It is precious. It is an opportunity to demonstrate here in physical incarnation the supreme truth of ultimate reality. So this emphasis must be kept in mind as we proceed along the inner path that leads to illumination. At times it will seem that greater attention is demanded for one area of consciousness over another, so that growth seems to become lopsided. But throughout the whole human opus, balance is called for. A natural rhythm must be established in which the adjustment of our natures take place. The mentalization of the thinking function must be balanced by the proper valuations of feeling. The soaring intuition must be brought to ground in the right use of sensation. So at the very outset of our journey, we are reminded of the operative square of consciousness. The operative square, we may be speculative masons, but we have to become operative masons in the world where we are. Where we are, as we are. Represented here, this operative square of consciousness is eyes, ear, voice, and feet, the quaternity of functions by which we are oriented to and established in the world of manifested existence. And the very symbols used remind us that it is here and now not somewhere else, in physical existence, in incarnation, that our ultimate achievement must take place. Tremendous, isn't it, in this opening paragraph. Here and now, in physical incarnation, and the very symbols remind us of that. The eyes, the ear, the voice, and the feet. Well, I hope I haven't kept you too long.